Hey guys, my name is Alex, and you're listening to the Thousand Movie Project podcast. My favorite line lately from this Doja Cat binge I've been on is from Paint the Town Red, where she goes, "My happiness is all of your misery. I put good dick all in my kidneys." Which is a brilliant line, but you can't go around like quoting it and talking about it and celebrating it. I can't, because I work at a grocery store. But like the way she breaks up the syllables and the way it kind of like rolls off the tongue, not the dick, but like the way that the phrase rolls off the tongue, it's fun. It's language made play. And it reminds me, this is maybe like a lofty sounding comparison, but I think it works. It reminds me of one of my favorite recordings ever, which is the recording of T.S. Eliot reading his very long poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
"And when I am formulated, sprawling on a pin, when I am pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways?"
The other night at work, once the store was closed and we were shelving the last bit of backstock in the snacks aisle, I was talking with a colleague when a Spice Girls song came on overhead from the speakers in the ceiling. This colleague is only 22 years old. She thinks it's really neat that I was alive when this song came out, and she said, did you listen to Spice Girls a lot when you were a kid? And what I thought she was asking me, the sentence that I kind of completed in my head when she was voicing the first half of it, was I thought she was asking me if I liked Spice Girls when I was a kid. And I said, yes, of course I liked the Spice Girls. Everybody loved the Spice Girls. But then I realized she wasn't asking me if I had liked the Spice Girls back in the 90s, which is admittedly a stupid question. She was asking me if I listened to the Spice Girls a lot at like the peak of their popularity, 1997, 1998. And the answer to that was no. She said, if you liked them so much, why didn't you listen to them? And the answer is basically like I was super homophobic and misogynistic in the way that 7, 8, 9-year-old boys tended to be, more so in the 90s than today, but I can't really explain it now, nor could I have explained it then, but as a little kid, I was deeply afraid of admitting that I liked any song that was sung by a woman. I didn't want to admit that I liked any TV show of which a woman was the protagonist, like even Sabrina the Teenage Witch. I watched that fucking religiously. I caught every rerun. There were certain episodes I knew almost word for word, and yet never discussed it with a friend. Nor did any of the boys at my school ever discuss it with me, even though I'm pretty sure all of us were watching it, because now, if I bring up Melissa Joan Hart in conversation, everyone's eyes light up. But yeah, in those years, it's not like I understood anything about sexuality and gender, like, but I had definitely been called a sissy, and I knew it was bad among boys to be a sissy, that a sissy was just generally a boy who did girly things, who was dainty, who was skittish, who preferred to be indoors, preferred quiet settings to loud ones. I just figured that anything made, any work of art created by a woman was inherently girly. I was just kind of riffing about this whole experience to my colleague, and then I told her after a while, like, I just feel shitty even remembering this and trying to describe it. And she said, if it makes you feel any better, when I was in elementary school, it was really fun watching all the boys like pretend that they hated Justin Bieber, but at the same time noticing that the only time those boys would stop talking is when a Justin Bieber song came on the radio. I found an artist on Instagram this month on that newer, artsier account that I made for the podcast, and I am obsessed with this dude's work. This might be the only content creator on Instagram where I've actually been thinking about like activating that Instagram function where they will notify you anytime this person posts anything. His name is Brian Huntress, H-U-N-T-R-E-S-S, and he's an illustrator, he's a painter, a musician. He makes stop motion music videos for his own tracks. And he mentioned in one of these stop motion music videos that among the greatest artistic influences in his life has been the rapper Missy Elliott. It was the one reference among like a litany of appreciative references to other artists that made me kind of sit up straight. Like, oh, that's interesting. Missy Elliott, I wouldn't have expected that. But then when I investigated that reflex, and I was like, why is it making a splash with me? I think in retrospect, it's because like even now, in my 30s and looking around at artists in that kind of age bracket, I still very seldom hear a guy shouting out a woman as a source of creative inspiration. But then that made me remember what it was like to be seeing and hearing Missy Elliott everywhere for a while. I think back in like the late 90s and early 2000s. And as I was reflecting on that, I was like, man, she was so crazy popular. And maybe it's just the case that that's how famous people got in the 90s before the internet had really taken off. Where if you were a musician and you made it through the gates and you got into magazines and you were being interviewed on MTV, that was it. You'd made it. And everyone in America was going to know your name. And then, you know, she disappeared for a few years. This is my impression of things. She disappeared for a while. She came back when I was in college with like a really hit single. And then suddenly, I was seeing her everywhere again. Billboards and Pepsi ads on TV, performing live at music shows. It's got to be a full-time job just to shoulder that much fame. To be at the forefront of whatever your artistic scene is. Doing interviews, making appearances, going on tours, meetings for endorsements, and managing your own money, and auditing the people who manage your money. I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast before, but there's like a really great interview Seth Rogen gave to Marc Maron. He was mentioning how common it is for celebrities, particularly actors, to go broke, even though they're being paid huge sums of money. The reason they go broke is because the people that they have hired to manage their money are robbing them, little by little by little. And so, in order to sort of stay afloat and make sure that everything is accounted for, people in Hollywood, people who find themselves in possession of so much wealth, they end up having to hire watchers to watch their money, and then hire auditors who are essentially watchmen to watch the watchmen who are watching your money. You know who still tours the world from that late 90s? Early 2000s rap scene is Nelly. I found out that Nelly has, apparently he's back in the news like as of this weekend because he just sold half of his catalog for $50 million. But I found out that Nelly has this effusive reputation, at least on Reddit, for being like the nicest guy in the world. I think the conversation about it kicked off because of a video somebody took. It went semi-viral, where Nelly is greeting a fan backstage at one of his shows. It's a teenager, he's in a wheelchair. It looks as if he's maybe got some kind of muscular issue, and he also appears to be nonverbal. And this kid is like ecstatic to meet Nelly, and Nelly kinda, like, it's very charming. He crouches down and kinda mirrors that kid's energy, and he does like this excited dance in front of the chair as he's approaching, and then he takes off his leather jacket, he turns it forward, and he swings it around the shoulder of this kid in the wheelchair, giving it to him as a gift. It's a nice video, it's charming if you allow yourself to be charmed by that kind of thing. I don't know if you feel this cynical, but whenever I see something very sweet, something that appears to be genuine, something that endears me toward a celebrity, I immediately, reflexively remind myself, like, these people have publicity teams, and it's very likely that what you're looking at, fabrication, an algorithmic formulation. Like, there's that one video, I can't even watch it, but where Jonathan Majors is allegedly breaking up a street fight, it is so clearly a publicity stunt. These two teenagers are fighting on a street or something, and then Jonathan Majors swings in like Mr. T.
Yeah, well, you're so skinny, your eyes are in single file.
You're so ugly, your ears stick out to get away from your face.
Well, your mama is
so... Hold on, wait a minute. Don't bring anyone mother into this. She ain't here. If it wasn't for your mother, you wouldn't be here. So remember, when you put down one mother, you put down mothers all over the world.
Mr. T steps into frame once these kids are about to insult each other's mothers. But he's kind of turning into frame as if he was standing just off camera, like immediately off camera this whole time, listening and nodding along as they mocked each other's bodies. And he's like totally cool with it until they mention moms. And then he's like, whoa. Too far. But in the case of the Nelly video, what seems to back it up is that a lot of people swung into the comments with anecdotes about how Nelly did this for their friend, or went and attended some kind of benefit, he did a charity thing. It does seem a little weird when I think about it, that there would be like a passionate teenage Nelly fan in 2023, but I guess that's partly the internet. It's definitely what happened for me in cultivating my interests. When I was 13 and 14 years old, I noticed that people were buying DVD players and DVDs, and so sort of in sync with that, they were purging their VCRs and their VHS collections. And I didn't have like a credit card at the time, obviously. So with my whatever money I had, allowance or gift money, I would go to CVS and I would get Visa gift cards. And then I would use those Visa gift cards on eBay and Amazon in order to buy old movies on cassette. And I could get them for like $4 a piece. And I would watch them on the VCR in my bedroom really late at night when my parents were asleep, because they were all movies that like I wasn't allowed to watch because they were too sexual, too violent, or they had drugs in them, whatever. But so like in 2004, 2005, I was mired in all this 1970s, 1980s mostly like crime cinema. So I would be at school, I was like asking people if they had seen Magnum Force yet. And they would be like, what the fuck is Magnum Force? And I was like, it's the sequel to Dirty Harry. Okay, I don't know. When did it come out? 1973, have you seen it? I guess if you were 13 years old today and you did come across a Nelly video on YouTube and you're like, oh my God. Like if you really fell in love with it, it would be awesome. Cause you would have like a fucking millennia's worth of content to pour through from scratch about that whole era in hip hop from like, what, 1998 to 2010. I remember paying attention to it on the periphery of my life because my brother was really into that scene and it was so fucking crazy dramatic. Imagine if you could take all that shit as like one box set narrative. Like if Ken Burns did a 9-hour documentary about like hip hop at the end of the 90s, because I imagine like the amount of footage you could find on YouTube is immense. I did an episode last year of the podcast where I read through some of the data points from Pornhub's, whatever it was, 2019 data dump or 2020. And one of those data points was the fact that Pornhub is a host to over 200 years of footage, which is not to say like your favorite porno hits from 1824 to today. I mean that if you tried to watch all of the porn on Pornhub, it would take you more than 200 years. And imagine how much footage there is of like TRL and music videos and interviews and concerts and DVD featurettes about those performers and bands and shit. MTV footage running for centuries. You could take that footage all in your kidneys.
If things start looking fuzzy and blurred, you get your eyes checked right away. Okay?
Okay.
Okay.